is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Rabbis, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres calls on the U.S. to lift or waive all sanctions on Iran as agreed under the 2015 nuclear deal. The Yemeni army says it has made gains in the fight against former regime loyalists and militia groups in the flashpoint city of Ma'arib. And a UN report says economic impact from the plunge in tourism since the coronavirus pandemic emerged last year could top $4 trillion. Hello and welcome, everybody, here in Iranian capital Tehran. This is World News. Our top story for this half hour: UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has called on U.S. President Joe Biden to lift or waive all sanctions on Iran as agreed under the 2015 nuclear deal. In a report to the UN Security Council, Guterres urged the United States to extend the waivers with regard to oil trade with Tehran. He also called for fully renewing waivers for nuclear non-proliferation projects. The UN chief's appeal comes as Iran and the remaining signatories of the nuclear deal are engaged in talks to revive the agreement. The accord got into trouble in 2018 when the U.S. withdrew from it and reinstated sanctions on Iran. Tehran responded by rolling back its commitments. Iran says the U.S. must now remove all sanctions. Iran's president has slammed the U.S. administration for continuing what he calls its economic terrorism against the Iranian nation. Hassan Rouhani says U.S. President Joe Biden is still waging, quote, an economic war that his predecessor Donald Trump started against Iran. Rouhani says Biden is committing the same crimes that Trump did by blocking Iran's access to drug and foodstuff through sanctions. The Iranian president has blasted Biden for going back on his election campaign promise to rejoin the 2015 nuclear deal and lift sanctions on Iran. Political commentator Tawhid Asadi says even the United Nations that the U.S. has so much influence on is critical of Washington's hostile policies.
Well, the fact that United Nations is a heavily influenced body by the United States is something I think there is no doubt about. But the recent report and the recent statements that we heard from Mr. Guterres is an indicative of the very fact that even this heavily influenced body cannot put up with the U.S. administration policies. Of course, when he was not the president and he was campaigning for the presidency, he started with some, let's say, statements just putting emphasis on its willingness towards having better relations and having more commitment and trying to fix the problems that exist in U.S.-Iran relations. But the thing is that when it comes to practice, after he could actually become the president, the thing was that he continued and he stick to the same trajectory of the failed foreign policy that Trump started. And of course, Obama was kind of following the same trajectory. The same continuation of a hostile approach has been on the floor pertaining to Iran, either with Biden administration or Trump or anyone else, at least for the past 4 decades.
Iran's president-elect Ebrahim Raisi has met with other hopefuls who ran in the June 18th presidential election. The former six candidates announced their readiness to cooperate with Raisi's administration. Participants in the meeting exchanged views on the existing problems and possible solutions to them. The Iranian president-elect expressed hope that such meetings continue in the future. He said now that the time for competition has come to an end, everyone must cooperate to address public concerns. Raisi stressed that the Iranian nation should know that all political parties aim to solve people's problems. Raisi will succeed incumbent President Hassan Rouhani. The Yemeni army says it has launched a missile attack against sensitive military targets in the country's Ma'arib city. The army said it used ballistic missiles to hit those targets. It said dozens of Saudi-backed forces, including several military commanders, were killed or wounded. The Yemeni army dismissed allegations that its operations in Ma'arib target civilians in residential areas. Ma'arib has witnessed fighting between the Yemeni army and forces loyal to the Saudi-backed former regime in the past several months. Members of the Ansar Allah movement are also helping the army in its operations to retake Ma'arib. The city is the last stronghold of the former regime loyalists. news review, and we look deeper into some of the top stories of the day. On this edition of the program, Germany's defense ministry says the country has completed its troop withdrawal from Afghanistan after nearly two decades of engagement. Germany had 1,100 soldiers in the Central Asian country before its drawdown, second only to the United States. Nearly 150,000 Germans had served in Afghanistan since 2001, 59 of which were killed. In April, Berlin announced its plan to pull out all of its troops from Afghanistan by early July. That after U.S. President Joe Biden declared that all American soldiers will leave the country, the war-torn country, that is, by September the 11th. Tens of thousands of civilians have been killed since the U.S. and its allies started their invasion of Afghanistan. Well, joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have Amin Alami, who's joining us from the Afghan capital, Kabul. Also, we have author and commentator John Stepling, who's with us from Inverurie, Norway. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Amin in Kabul. Amin, tell us more about the German troop withdrawal from Afghanistan and what it means in the bigger picture, i.e., Afghanistan's security.
Well, Badia, the withdrawal of German troops from Afghanistan takes place while the Taliban militants have in recent days and weeks expanded their attacks and bombings across Afghanistan. For instance, I can point out to the recent collapse of over 40 districts across this country, mainly in northern and southern parts of Afghanistan. But the recent developments, according to Afghanistan's defense ministry and Afghanistan's interior ministry, showed that the Afghan armed forces have successfully retaken some key districts from the Taliban. For instance, Khuz district in northern Baghlan province was recaptured by the Taliban early in the morning, as well as military sources in Parwan province, where it's located just close to capital Kabul. Also, they say that Shinwari district is captured again by Afghan military forces, and heavy military operations are on the way to retake Siargir district in Ghorban Valley, that is located on Kabul Highway Bamyan, Kabul-Bamyan Highway. In other development, the Taliban militants captured Al-Asai district in Kapisar province of Afghanistan, but in northern parts of this country, mainly in Balkh, where German troops were stationed, Afghan security forces say that they have some major achievements. For instance, they say that at least four districts around Balkh province have been retaken by Afghan security forces. In the meantime, Kaldar district in northern Balkh province was also captured by the Taliban. This is also worth mentioning, Badia, that the story of war and peace in Afghanistan seems to be vague and too much complex. That is why local Afghans and even top political elites and jihadi leaders have argued that the Afghan government needs to follow a strong war policy, as well as it needs to directly talk to the backers of the Taliban in order to convince the militant group to resume the peace negotiations with the Afghan government. But what remains to be as a bitter story or as a bitter truth in the Afghan society is that the Afghan locals or Afghan civilians are the main victims of the rising violence in this country. That is why in many cases they have picked up guns across various provinces, mainly in northern Afghanistan, against the Taliban to resist against Taliban attacks.
All right, thanks a lot. I mean, let's cross over now to John Stepling. Mr. Stepling, give us your thoughts on the overall troop withdrawal from Afghanistan, the foreign troop presence. It always galvanized the Taliban. They continued their attacks over the past two decades. The withdrawal of the forces now might leave a security vacuum. So talk to us about all of this in the overall picture, and what does the Afghan government have to do? What steps and measures do they have to implement to ensure their security?
Well, I think that if you listen to the rhetoric in Western media, and in U.S. media in particular, when Biden announced the troop withdrawal from Afghanistan, there was a very mixed reaction and was kind of nonpartisan, but all those linked to the defense industry were wringing their hands and crying crocodile tears about that the government in Kabul would fall, which I suspect it will, once the U.S. troops are gone and U.K. troops, German troops, they're all pulling out. But it does kind of beg the question, after 20 years, what was achieved besides the death of something like 200,000 civilians? I mean, the death toll is hard to calculate, as it is in Syria, Yemen, the entire region in these imperialist wars from the U.S. But it seems inevitable to me that the Taliban will once again take control of the country, and eventually, and it also, I suppose, bears mentioning that the Taliban has changed considerably over the last 20 years. They're a lot more politically savvy. Their presentation is more sophisticated, and their rhetoric is more sophisticated, even if their basic principles probably remain much the same. But the point is that this was a massive waste of resources, money, and human life in the pursuit of nothing achieved. I mean, nothing was achieved, and the premise was dubious at best. And in 2001, this is part of David Sanger, the New York Times. This is the guy who the Pentagon officially leaks information to. He said when Biden made the announcement, Biden was more interested in the U.S. economic crisis, rebuilding the roads and bridges and infrastructure and so forth. And this is probably actually true. The U.S., after the pandemic, we've seen, you know, a migration of wealth to the top, further consolidation, monopolization of retail, et cetera, massive job loss. That's the real crisis. The secondary implication of this troop withdrawal is that the real war they would like to fight is against Iran. They don't have the money or resources, frankly, to do it. But that's the long-term goal, and they have Israel and Saudi Arabia tied together, and they now cooperate, and that's the real goal. Afghanistan has ceased to have even symbolic importance, I don't think, certainly not for the domestic populace, nor does it in Germany. You know, I think Germans were asking, why were we ever there? And I think the question is, why is NATO even in existence anymore? Well, to carry out U.S. imperialist policy, essentially, is the answer. But I think we'll see the troops withdraw, maybe entirely, but I can't believe the U.S. involvement in Afghanistan is over. There'll be some premise, the Taliban, and there's a lot of backdoor communication. The Taliban will attack. The U.S. will show force and send in troops to quell the upsurge of violence, and they'll be back in business in Afghanistan. It might take a few years, but that's probably what's going to happen.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Let's leave it there. That was author and commentator John Stepling speaking to us from Indre, Norway. Also thanks to Amin Alami, our correspondent, joining us from the Afghan capital, Kabul. With that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of News Review. Do stay tuned. There's plenty more to come. Welcome back. UN report says global economy could lose over $4 trillion due to impacts of COVID-19 on tourism. The report says last year alone, worldwide drops in tourist arrivals resulted in more than $2 trillion in economic loss. It says the same amount is expected this year, depending on the distribution of COVID vaccines. The UN report says that things would be harder for developing countries as they face vaccine inequity. It says these countries have already seen a 60 to 80% decline in tourist arrivals. Last year, recently, some nations have eased travel curbs following mass vaccination programs. The UN report says international tourism is not expected to return to pre-pandemic levels until 2023 at the earliest. Australia has extended lockdown measures to more areas to fight flare-ups of the highly contagious Delta variant of COVID. Alice Springs has become the latest area to put restrictions after Brisbane, Sydney, Perth, and Darwin took similar measures. Now around half of Australians are under stay-at-home orders. Millions more are subject to movement restrictions and mandatory mask wearing. The country has been broadly successful in containing virus clusters, but now the authorities say they have to be cautious and take what they call tough decisions due to the Delta variant. The strain was first identified in India. Well, Canadian Indigenous community leaders and advocates have called for the cancellation of Canada Day following the discovery of unmarked mass graves. The activists say observing the upcoming national celebrations will be inconsiderate to all children whose lives were lost through the course of the country's history. Several Canadian cities have already canceled or altered plans to mark the holiday. Last month, 215 remains were found in unmarked graves on the grounds of a former Catholic Church residential school in British Columbia. Last Thursday, the remains of 751 children were found on the grounds of another former residential school for Indigenous children. The discoveries have sparked outrage among the First Nations people. Scores of people have died in Canada as a scorching heat wave hits the country's west since Friday. At least 230 people have died in British Columbia, more than half of them in the Vancouver area. Many of them were senior citizens. Local officials believe extreme heat has been a contributing factor. On Tuesday, Canada recorded its highest ever temperature for a third day in a row. It reached 49.5 degrees Celsius in Lytton, British Columbia. Weather services have issued alerts for several provinces. They warned that the historic heat wave persists through this week. Temperatures in Canada had never passed 45 degrees Celsius in the past. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, we are going to continue discussing Imam Khomeini's testament. where he explains the two weighty things, namely the Noble Quran and the Ahlul Bayt, or the infallible progeny of the Prophet of Islam. Imam Khomeini explains the great achievements of the Islamic Revolution and warns against the threats ahead of this revolution and the oppressed nations. Stay with us, please. Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, believed that the traditional jurisprudence is the explicator of the school of the Prophet and his infallible successors, and calls on the Iranian nation to stick to this school firmly. He writes in his testament, "I ask Muslim nations seriously and urgently to follow the infallible imams and the political, social, economic, and military culture of these great guides of mankind properly and wholeheartedly through sacrificing their souls and dear ones, so that they do not become deviated from the traditional jurisprudence, which is the school of prophethood and imamat, and guarantees the growth and grandeur of nations, and do not listen to the temptation of adversary enticers and enemies of truth and religion. And they should know that a single deviated step will be the prelude for collapse of religion, Islamic laws, and the divine rule of justice." Imam Khomeini attached high importance to congregational prayers, especially Friday prayers and morning ceremonies of the infallible imams, particularly Imam Hussein, peace upon him. He writes, "Never neglect Friday prayer and congregational prayer, which indicate the political aspect of prayer. This Friday prayer is among the greatest graces of Almighty God to the Islamic Republic of Iran. And people should never neglect the morning ceremonies of the infallible imams, especially the Lord of the Oppressed and Master of Martyrs, Abu Abdullah al-Hussein, peace upon him. And they should know that it is the order of the imams, peace upon them, to rever this historical epic of Islam, and whatever curse is uttered against the oppressors of Ahlul Bayt are all heroic cries of nations against the oppressive leaders throughout history. And it is necessary to loudly and effectively remind in the elegies and panegyrics of the rightful imams, the catastrophes and oppressions of every era and place." Imam Khomeini emphasizes that his testament is not limited to the Iranian nation, and that he has in fact addressed the entire Islamic world and the whole oppressed and downtrodden in the world. He writes, "We know that the Islamic Revolution, which cut the hand of the world devourers and oppressors from Iran, has triumphed with the unseen divine assistance. Had there not been the able hand of the one God, it would have been impossible for the 36 million population to triumph against such an anti-Islamic and anti-clergy propaganda, particularly during the recent 100 years, and such excessive seditious acts of the writers on media and speeches and anti-Islamic and anti-national circles, and so many centers of debauchery, gambling, drinks, and narcotics in order to draw the young generation to corruption and indifference and efforts to seclude and isolate the clergy and also divert many of them. It was impossible for this nation to rise up unanimously in such condition with a unified idea and the shouts of Allahu Akbar across the country to dismantle the internal and external powers with astonishing and miraculous sacrifices to hold the authority of the country. Thus, there is no doubt that the Islamic revolution of Iran is different from all revolutions, both in the emergence and quality of a struggle, and also the motive of revolution and uprising. No doubt, this divine present and unseen gift has been granted by the all-merciful God to this oppressed and looted nation. Imam Khomeini continues in his testament, Islam and the Islamic government is a divine phenomenon which, if it is put into practice, will secure in the best way the prosperity of our children in this world and the hereafter, and is able to efface oppressions, lootings, corruptions, and aggressions with red pen, blood, and take humans to their desirable ideal. Islam is the school which, unlike non-monotheistic schools, plays a role and interferes in and supervises all individual, social, material, spiritual, cultural, political, military, and economic efforts, and does not neglect even the most trivial points in the education of human being and the society and the material and spiritual progress. Now that with the help and grace of God, the Islamic Republic has been established by the able hand of the devoted nation, it is necessary for the nation to try to materialize and safeguard its whole contents as the preservation of Islam on top of all obligations. Today, it is an obligation, especially for the Iranian nation and the entire Muslims in general, to preserve this divine trust with all their effort and try to create the requirements of its survival and remove the barriers and problems. Imam Khomeini points to the element of safeguarding the victory, saying, undoubtedly, the element of survival of the Islamic revolution is the very element of victory. And the nation knows the element of victory. And the future generations will read in history that its two pillars have been the divine motive and the lofty purpose of Islamic rule. And that the convergence of the nation all over the country with one motto has been for this very motive and purpose. I recommend to all present and future generations that if they want Islam and the rule of God to survive powerfully and cut the hand of the internal and external colonialists and exploiters from your country, you should not lose this divine motive that Almighty God has recommended in the Noble Quran, and you should know that opposite of this motive, which is the element of victory and its survival, is forgetting the goal and discord and difference. It is not accidental that the propaganda horns across the world have focused all their efforts on rumors and seditious lies and spent billions of dollars on it. And the constant trips of the opponents of the Islamic Republic to the region are not without motive.
the debate.
Once again, targets in Iraq has been hit in its border with Syria. Iraq has condemned the U.S. airstrikes as a violation of its sovereignty and national security. Why would the U.S. target the legitimate forces of Iraq that it calls illegitimate, accusing them of targeting U.S. forces? This is the second time that the U.S. under Joe Biden has made the decision to strike Iraq. Will this risk a war between U.S. forces and the PMU forces? Stay tuned to the debate.
The Pentagon confirmed it carried out airstrikes in positions of Iraq's popular mobilization units on both sides of the country's border with Syria. The Pentagon claimed the Sunday night strikes were defensive and in retaliation for what it called the PMU's drone attacks on U.S. personnel and facilities in Iraq. But the PMU forces roundly rejected any involvement. They said they are part of Iraq's regular armed forces and that the soldiers who died in the U.S. raids were guarding the border. The PMU forces warned that they are ready to take revenge. The U.S. airstrikes are the second of their kind to be ordered by President Joe Biden against the PMU since he took office in January. Biden says the strikes are meant to end what he calls for forces attacks on U.S. interests, but Iraqis see things differently.
The Iraqi people, government, officials, factions, and political figures see this attack as a boon to Daesh and other terrorists in Iraq and Syria. Through this attack, the U.S. seeks to weaken PMU forces in Iraqi and Syrian border areas so that Daesh terrorists can enter the Iraqi territory and carry out terrorist attacks. Effectively, the U.S. is now standing united with Daesh against the people of Iraq and its interests.
The strikes have been condemned across the political spectrum in Iraq. Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi denounced the airstrikes as a blatant and unacceptable violation of Iraq's sovereignty and its national security. The Iraqi military also issued a rare statement saying the U.S. move was a breach of the country's sovereignty. Different factions in the Iraqi parliament also condemned the airstrikes and called for steps to ensure such attacks will not repeat. They say the solution is ending the U.S. military presence in Iraq. That would be in line with a resolution adopted by the Iraqi parliament in January 2020, which called on the government to end the presence of all foreign troops in the country. The Iraqi parliament passed a resolution days after the U.S. assassinated Iran's top general Qasem Soleimani, along with the deputy commander of the PMU forces, Abu Mehdi al-Muhandis, in an airstrike near Baghdad Airport. The U.S. has carried out more airstrikes on PMU positions ever since. During the period, Daesh terrorists have been the only other perpetrator of attacks on the popular forces.
Our guest joining us for this edition of the debate, Senior Research Fellow at the Global Policy Institute, George Samieli, joins us from Budapest. And we also have writer and political analyst John White joining us from Edinburgh. I'd like to welcome you both. And John White, let me first go to you and ask you about the U.S. version of what has happened, in which it said the U.S. military targeted operational and weapons storage facilities at two locations in Syria and one in Iraq in response to drone attacks by what the U.S. calls militia against U.S. personnel and facilities in Iraq.
Well, the U.S. presence of countries is entirely in violation of international law. They are not there at the invitation of the legally constituted governments of both countries. Indeed, on the contrary, they're there at the with the opposition of both governments. So they are an occupying force, and therefore their presence in both countries is illegal. Now, it seems clear to me that the Biden administration constitutes no step change from the previous Trump administration or the previous Obama administration. It's a case of the new boss, same as the old boss. The only difference is one of approach. So this was a vile act of international brigandage and piracy against popular mobilization units in Iraq, who have been the only thing standing between Iraq's sovereignty and status as a secular state and the black flag of ISIS or Salafi jihadism flying over Baghdad. It's a disgrace. It's not in keeping with the trajectory of the region, which is towards an axis of resistance against U.S. imperialism and all its conceits.
Well, Joe Samieli, the U.S. Secretary of State, Anthony Blinken, has said there are airstrikes against what he calls Iran-backed militias. in Iraq and Syria over the weekend were a necessary, and I'm quoting him, and appropriate action meant to limit the risk of escalation. How does that limit the risk of escalation?
Well, of course, it doesn't limit the risk of escalation in any way whatsoever. It's very amusing that the United States keeps repeating this mantra of, well, this is a proportionate response against Iran-backed militia, and that the United States is present in Iraq legally, and the only reason why it's in Iraq is that it is fighting ISIS. Now, of course, as my colleague has just pointed out, and the forces that are fighting ISIS the most effectively have been the forces that the United States has just struck, these so-called Iran-backed militia. And of course, the forces that have been fighting ISIS the least effectively have been the forces by the United States. Now, of course, the United States is not present in Iraq legally. I mean, that's the point. I mean, the Pentagon statement and the statement of Anthony Blinken is completely false. The United States has no legal justification for being in Iraq. It was in January 2020, following the assassination of General Soleimani, that the Iraqi parliament demanded that the United States leave Iraq. The United States has not done so, has no intention of doing so. So it's, you know, the claim that somehow the United States is acting legally is completely false. And the rationale behind the strike, we're fighting the Iran-backed militia, is itself bogus, because these are the forces that are actually fighting ISIS the most effectively.
Okay, so if you don't mind, John White, holding on to that thought that the U.S. is not in Iraq legally, this is what the Prime Minister, Mustafa al-Kadhimi, has said along with the Iraqi army. We condemn, quote, the U.S. airstrike that targeted a site last night on the Iraqi-Syrian border, which represents a blatant and unacceptable violation of Iraqi sovereignty and Iraqi national security, according to all international conventions. Now, this is not the first time that this has happened, John White, and if the U.S. is in Iraq legally, I'm wondering what the Iraqi officials actually are saying to the U.S., to the respective parties there in the U.S., like what the Prime Minister says, don't do it again, which the U.S. has done. I mean, what does Iraq say to the U.S., and what can the U.S. say in return?
Well, George, I'm always absolutely correct. What was taken in the Iraqi parliament in January 2020 to expel all U.S. officials, and the fact that they're still there, this proves beyond peradventure that this is not a democracy acting in the interest of democracy, it's an empire acting in the interests of empire. Obviously, the Iraqis don't have the power of the U.S., but there does have to come a stage where the U.N. intervenes to condemn resolutely and unreservedly U.S. machinations in Iraq and in Syria. This is not about any administration. Everybody was blinded by Joe Biden's folksy approach to politics, and he was going to be a step change from Donald Trump. No. As I said earlier, this is just a difference in approach. The objective is the same, which is to maintain U.S. fading hegemony in the Middle East and on a wider level across the world. So the tectonic plates of geopolitical and geostrategic powers are shifting from the West to the East, and thus we are in a period of interregnum. And it's a very dangerous period, because no empire leaves the stage of history without a hard-fought struggle. And this issue and this incident is part of that struggle. The Iraqi people, the Syrian people, are victims of this U.S. empire, but I have confidence that before long, this U.S. empire will cease to be a realistically strong force in the region. The people of the region have rejected them. It's only a matter of time before they understand that they have no longer any purchase in that region or anywhere else in the global south.
We have talked about or touched on the fact, George Samueli, that Iraq has been able to defeat the Daesh terrorists. It was successful in doing that. And one of the reasons that it was able to do that was because of the PMU forces, the same forces that the U.S. keeps saying these are Iran-backed militias, of which it basically says they're illegitimate. And an observation here that I'd like to get your reaction on this, George Samueli, is that this attack took place the day after there was a major military parade which featured these PMU forces. And that was a grand parade, and it was really a show of force. Do you think that the timing of this has anything to do with that in terms of the U.S. choosing the day after this military parade took place?
Well, it's quite possible. I don't know that for a fact. But there's no question that the United States is desperate to ensure that any of the indigenous forces basically are unable to perform effectively. I mean, let's remember, there would have been no ISIS had there been no U.S. intervention in Iraq. And we know that from 2014 on, the Obama administration was looking on benignly as ISIS grew in power in Iraq and in Syria. We know this is a record of this, that we know that they were looking for ISIS to effect regime change in Iraq and regime change in Syria. And, you know, the United States only took the fight against ISIS seriously, if we can say, if we can even use the term seriously in this context, after President Putin announced in September 2015 that Russia was going to step in and take care of business with ISIS. And suddenly the Obama administration said, oh, yeah, we're in on this as well. But up until then, the United States was very, very happy to see the rise of ISIS, just as today the United States is the biggest protector of Al-Qaeda in the Middle East, because it knows perfectly well that the biggest center of Al-Qaeda forces is in Syria, in Idlib, and it continues to resist any attempt by the Syrian government and Russia to bring this Al-Qaeda enclave to an end.
Okay, it was in December of this past year, John White, when the U.S. Actually made an announcement that it's going to withdraw its forces from Iraq. It never followed through on that, per se. Of course, we could always say that the U.S. never really pulls out any of its forces completely, like in the case of Afghanistan. Nevertheless, do you think that there's a possibility that the U.S., knowing that the Iraqi parliamentarians, many of them want the U.S. out, many officials want the U.S. out of Iraq, but the U.S. wants to stay there because of Syria, in order for there to be some geographic advantage in that sense? Is that a reason why you think the U.S. is steadfast in staying in Syria, in Iraq?
Absolutely. The U.S. has been at best to undermine the Syrian government throughout its long conflict with ISIS and other Salafi jihadi forces. If not for U.S. machination in Syria, Salafi jihadism would have been smashed long before now. The U.S. is also under pressure from its regional allies, Israel and Saudi Arabia, to maintain a presence in order to bolster their machinations in the region. And these are two sectarian states that have no interest in seeing Syria being stabilized, no interest in seeing Iraq being stabilized, because for them the behemoth in the region is Iran. And the only reason that these countries despise Iran, the only reason these countries have set their face against Iran, is nothing to do with Iran's domestic or internal issues or the nature of its state. Every country has its own domestic challenges. It's because Iran does not bow. That's the only reason. Iran is a target, and the road to Tehran for the U.S. and its regional allies leads through Damascus and Iraq.
Okay. George Samioli, in the bigger picture, the U.S. president's, during his campaign pledges and even when he came into office, on different occasions has said, we're winding down the wars, in reference to, of course, Afghanistan first, and then looking at what is happening in particular in Iraq and then Syria, saying that, you know, they want to reduce not only their presence, but as recently as just weeks ago, it confirmed that it's reducing by 1/8 the number of Patriot anti-missile batteries in the Middle East, which consisted of hundreds of troops, aircraft, that they are removing or have removed. And this would be from Iraq, from Jordan, from Kuwait, and from Saudi Arabia. And, of course, their thing is with China, that it's a national security threat. They're going to focus on China and Russia. So then this, you know, strike comes, this is the second time now. It doesn't really look like they're going to disengage from this region, does it?
No, it really doesn't. And I think the key there is the role of Iran. Now, if you look at Iran, I mean, Iran has obviously been subject to consistent U.S. aggression since the Iranian Revolution. Iran has been subject to Israeli aggression for decades. And how does Iran resist? Well, obviously, Iran resists via its ballistic missile program, but it also resists via its proxy forces. And yeah, of course, it does have these proxy forces throughout the Middle East that it will initiate should there be a conflict between Iran and the United States or Iran and Israel. So these proxy forces, whether it's Syria, whether it's in Iraq, whether it's in Lebanon, are absolutely vital to Iran's strategic interests. And of course, that's why Israel has been consistently targeting these forces and why the United States is anxious to target them, because they know that in any conflict with Iran, these, whatever you call them, these proxy, Iran proxy forces will be a very important part of Iranian resistance.
Trying to figure out the role of Israel in this, John, if you can help me out. You know, we have noticed how Israel has time and again attacked Syria on a number of occasions. And quite interestingly, there's been a lull in that situation. But since we've talked about Iran and since the U.S. keeps referring to the PMU forces as being malicious, backed or aligned by Iran, we're under the impression, however, that there's these nuclear negotiations that the Biden administration is saying they're focused on. And because of that, Pentagon has actually said that they see this window where they're if once that comes about and if there is an agreement, that you know, they're going to refocus or put their focus onto that alleged China threat. How do you see it?
Well, they're really doing their best to undermine the JCPOA, and they're doing their best under the new Prime Minister Naftali Bennett to undermine these talks in Vienna. This is one of the most weird coalitions of any so-called democratic government we've ever seen. They cannot stand the fact that Iran may return to being a power that can put its oil on the world markets and can have sanctions lifted, because for the Israelis, Iran is a menace that they cannot get rid of in their minds, because they understand that they are so vulnerable. Israel is a giant with feet of clay in the region. They're very vulnerable, and they see Iran as a country that will ultimately speed the way towards full Palestinian freedom, self-determination, and the end of the Zionist project. That is what they fear most. Every Israeli government, regardless of who leads it, sees Iran as a direct threat to its expansionism, to its system of apartheid and ethnic cleansing and subjugation of the Palestinian people. So the Israelis are doing their best to lobby behind closed doors to the Biden administration, because the Biden administration has articulated that it wants to have wants to refocus on a two-state solution, even though that's dead in the water. So Iran is the solution to the freedom of the Palestinian people. The Israelis understand that, and that's why they fear Iran so much, and that's why they get so hysterical when it comes to anything involving Iran.
Okay. George Samueli, so now we have this strike, the second one that has taken place. The group that's within the PMU forces, as it was reported, they have vowed revenge. They have vowed to take down any U.S. airplane that actually flies over Iraq. If something like that happens, and I know it's talking about something that hasn't happened yet, but hypothetically, do you think that this is going to mean war?
Well, I mean, there's war already ongoing. Yes, I think that if there is indeed a retaliation against U.S. forces, then the United States will escalate. I mean, it will escalate with attacks against Iraq. It will escalate with further attacks in Syria. I mean, what it's doing in Syria is already just, I mean, that it's kind of almost, so it's beyond any kind of description as humanity. I mean, the horrific sanctions and everything. But in the case of Syria, it has pretty much a blank check. No one, as far as American public opinion is concerned, no one complains about any U.S. actions in Syria. Iraq is a little bit different because, at least in the case of Iraq, the United States tries to make this pretense, however fraudulent, that it is in Iraq at the invitation of the Baghdad government, and it is ostensibly there in order to help it fight ISIS. Of course, it's absolutely bogus, but if there is an escalation of conflict in Iraq, then it's going to become ever more difficult to maintain this fiction. But, you know, the U.S. propaganda machine is so powerful that, you know, I wouldn't have believed that after what happened in January 2020, after the Iraqi parliament had asked the United States to leave, that the United States would just continue ignoring the wishes of the Iraqi parliament and still insist before the world, oh, we are here at the invitation of the Iraqi people, the very Iraqi people that have just been asked you to leave. So the U.S. propaganda machine is quite relentless in spreading fraud and lies.
Okay, thank you so much. We're going to end it there. That's Senior Research Fellow at Global Policy Institute, George Tomielli. Thank you for your comments. Also, John White, thank you, from Edinburgh, writer and political analyst. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Debate. From Mikhail Vitak, my entire team in the capital, Tehran, it's goodbye until next time.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام می‌گذاره، همه این ارزش‌ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program's to my brother, and I'm your host, Mehdi. We're talking about the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Please stay with us. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of